Well, it looks like we should be able to finish our chapter tonight, this 19th in the first series in Essays on the Gita entitled Equality of Supreme Importance in the Practice of Yoga. Sri Aurobindo has been describing the differences among tamasic equality and Rajasic equality, and we have yet to deal with sattvic equality. So on to that next. And he's making a point often through here, comparing the philosophy developed in Greece, which we know as Stoicism, is developed following Zeno, who was an Athenian, and this philosophy came into being, well, at least by 108 BCE. It's from a term that means painted porch, stoa poikile. Stoa is porch, so this was where they met, on the painted porch. It's really a philosophy with several features to it, but the one Sri Aurobindo is drawing attention to here is its indifference to pleasure or pain, that we should practice and develop a kind of resignation that withdraws our attention and approval and dismay from the things of the senses. Apatheia is the Greek word for that. So this would mean a strong, firm refusal to be dismayed by the blows or the allurements of life. So you can see why it would be considered in some ways in the part of the same thing that we discuss as samatha, samatva. So we begin now. The Gita, making its call on the warrior nature of Arjuna, starts with this heroic movement. It calls on him to turn on the great enemy, desire, and slay it. Its first description of equality is that of the Stoic philosopher. He whose mind is undisturbed in the midst of sorrows and amid pleasures is free from desire, from whom liking and fear and wrath have passed away, is the sage of settled understanding, who in all things is without affection, though visited by this good or that evil, and neither hates nor rejoices. His intelligence sits firmly founded in wisdom. And that's in the second chapter of the Gita, shlokas 56 and 7, and we're going to move on to a couple of more that follow upon it. If one abstains from food, it says, giving a physical example, the object of sense ceases to affect, but the affection itself of the sense, the rasa, remains. It is only when, even in the exercise of the sense, it can keep back from seeking its sensuous aim in the object, artha, and abandon the affection, the desire for the pleasure of taste, that the highest level of the soul is reached. So this means acting within the orbit of the senses, but without the typical pursuit of the aim, which is the delight of the contact. So, and that's Shloka 259. It is By using the mental organs on the objects, ranging over them with the senses, Vishayan Indriyaish Charan, but with senses subject to the self, freed from liking and disliking, that one gets into a large and sweet clearness of soul and temperament in which passion and grief find no place. And that's 264. All desires have to enter into the soul as waters into the sea, and yet it has to remain immovable, filled but not disturbed. So in the end, all desires can be abandoned. To be freed from wrath and passion and fear and attraction is repeatedly stressed as a necessary condition of the liberated status. And for this, we must learn to bear their shocks, which cannot be done without exposing ourselves to their causes. He who can bear here in the body the velocity of wrath and desire is the yogin, the happy man. That's chapter 5, shloka 23. So again, it indicates the victory is not to be won in isolation, in a cave, having renounced the world, but here, undisturbed, in the midst of the challenge. Tidiksha, the will and power to endure, is the means. And this is going to be chapter 2, shlokas 14 and 15. The material touches, which cause heat and cold, happiness and pain, things transient which come and go, these learn to endure. For the man whom these do not trouble nor pain, the firm and wise who is equal in pleasure and suffering, makes himself apt for immortality, amrita. The equal souled has to bear suffering and not hate, to receive pleasure and not rejoice. Even the physical affections are to be mastered by endurance, and this too is part of the Stoic discipline. Age, death, suffering, pain are not fled from, but accepted and vanquished by a high indifference. And here we have a footnote. Dhiras tatra na muhyati, says the Gita. And that's 2:13. Literally, it means the serene, dhira, does not grieve. The serene does not grieve. The strong and wise soul is not perplexed, troubled, or moved by them, but still they are accepted only to be conquered. Jara marana mokshaya yatanti. And that's 7:29. And it means literally for liberation from old age and death. So this high indifference is being seated in a wise poise of the mind, in a sense, looking down from above, dhira. Another way you could translate 2:14 that might be a little clearer, rendered into English, is the contacts of the senses with their objects create heat and cold, pain and pleasure. They are impermanent. Endure them. So it's the idea that the senses, in reaching the objects, cause these experiences to arise, which we interpret as one thing or the other. Pleasant, unpleasant. But those don't last. And so endure them, titiksha, is the aim. Endurance leads to something more, eventually leads beyond all these types of equality within the fields of the gunas and their intermixture, beyond tamasic equality and rajasic equality and even sattvic equality, to get finally to the spiritual. And Sri Aurobindo is driving us there, one paragraph at a time. Back to his essay. Not to flee, appalled from nature in her lower masks, but to meet and conquer her is the true instinct of the strong nature. Purusha Rishabha, which means the leonine soul among men. Thus compelled, she throws aside her mask and reveals to him his true nature as the free soul, not her subject, but her king and lord, Swarat Samrat, chief among men. That's 215. So you see, we've gone back and forth through a number of chapters. Sometimes we're in chapter 2, sometimes we're in chapter 7, sometimes we're in chapter 5. But the Gita accepts this stoic discipline, this heroic philosophy, on the same condition that it accepts the tamasic recoil. It must have above it the sattvic vision of knowledge. At its root, the aim at self-realization, and in its steps, the ascent to the divine nature. In other words, any of these forms of equality is welcome and appropriate at a given stage of development, because each leads you beyond the raw grip of nature. You're developing at one level what will become equality at a higher level and eventuate in the spiritual. A stoic discipline which merely crushed down the common affections of our human nature, although less dangerous than a tamasic weariness of life, unfruitful pessimism, and sterile inertia, because it would at least increase the power and self-mastery of the soul, would still be no unmixed good, since it might lead to insensibility and inhuman isolation without giving the true spiritual release. The Stoic equality is justified as an element in the discipline of the Gita because it can be associated with and can help to the realization of the free, immutable self in the mobile human being, param drishtva, and to status in that new self-consciousness, esha brahmistiti. So the first Sanskrit there, param drishtva, that's 259, and it means literally having seen the Supreme. And then esha brahmistiti is 272, and it means literally, this is the Brahman state. Awakening by the understanding to the highest, which is beyond even the discerning mind, put force on the self by the self to make it firm and still, and slay this enemy who is so hard to assail, desire. Both the tamasic recoil of escape and the rajasic movement of struggle and victory are only justified when they look beyond themselves through the sattvic principle to the self-knowledge which legitimizes both the recoil and the struggle. So each, tamasic, rajasic, sattvic, samatha, lead beyond to the spiritual. So they're all welcome, even if it looks like first you're shrinking from the world and then violently vomiting it out and then indifferently rising above it. They're all poises, they're all movements, and movements generally upward if they're followed successively. The pure philosopher, the thinker, the born sage, not only relies upon the sattvic principle in him as his ultimate justification, but uses it from the beginning as his instrument of self-mastery. He starts from the sattvic equality. He's talking about the pure philosopher here. He starts from the sattvic equality. He too observes the transitoriness of the material and external world and its failure to satisfy the desires or to give the true delight, but this causes in him no grief, fear, or disappointment. He observes all with an eye of tranquil discernment and makes his choice without repulsion or perplexity. The enjoyments born of the touches of things are causes of sorrow. They have a beginning and an end. Therefore, the sage, the man of awakened understanding, Buddha, does not place his delight in these. So, the enjoyments, bhoga. And this is chapter 5, shloka 22. The causes of sorrow, dukkha, yonaya. So the womb of suffering are these very touches of things. They have a beginning and an end. The wise one, Buddha, sees beyond it and does not place his delight in these, ramate. Quote, the self in him is unattached to the touches of external things. He finds his happiness in himself. This is the earlier shloka. This is 5:21. Atmani yat sokam. He sees, as the Gita puts it, that he is himself, his own enemy and his own friend. And therefore he takes care not to dethrone himself by casting his being into the hands of desire and passion. Natmanam avasadayet, but delivers himself out of that imprisonment by his own inner power. Udharet atmana atmanam. For whoever has conquered his lower self finds in his higher self his best friend and ally. Udharet. That's 6:5, by the way. Udharet means lift, rise up, raise yourself through the power of the self. So as we grow, the self above, in a sense, lifts up the lower self into the high self. They are not, after all, opposites or ultimately distinct. They are really the same being, are they not? He becomes satisfied with knowledge, master of his senses, a yogin by sattvic equality. For equality is yoga, samatvam yoga utyate. Regarding alike, clod and stone and gold, tranquil and self-poised in heat and cold, suffering and happiness, honor and disgrace. 248. So you see equality to the physical, buffets of senses, equality to the passionate surgings of desire and our experiences emotionally, and also those things which beset our mind. He is equal in soul to friend and enemy, and to neutral and indifferent, because he sees that these are transitory relations born of the changing conditions of life. Even by the pretensions of learning and purity and virtue and the claims to superiority which men base upon these things, he is not led away. He is equal-souled to all men, to the sinner and the saint, to the virtuous, learned, and cultured Brahmin and the fallen outcast. All these are the Gita's descriptions of the sattvic equality. And they sum up well enough what is familiar to the world as the calm philosophic equality of the sage. Where then is the difference between this and the larger equality taught by the Gita? It lies in the difference between the intellectual and philosophic discernment and the spiritual, the Vedantic knowledge of unity on which the Gita founds its teaching. The philosopher maintains his equality by the power of the buddhi, the discerning mind. But even that by itself is a doubtful foundation. For, though master of himself on the whole, by a constant attention or an acquired habit of mind, in reality, he is not free from his lower nature, and it does actually assert itself in many ways, and may at any moment take a violent revenge for its rejection and suppression. For always, the play of the lower nature is a triple play, and the rajasic and tamasic qualities are ever lying in wait for the sattvic man. Remember, we live here in the field of the gunas, and all three are always present. So there is no absolute sattvic conquest bringing equilibrium to your experience of nature. It will be undermined and beset by rajas and tamas. So don't be smug. Even the mind of the wise man who labors for perfection is carried away by the vehement insistence of the senses. Chapter 2, Shloka 60. Perfect security can only be had by resorting to something higher than the sattvic quality, something higher than the discerning mind, to the self. Not the philosopher's intelligent self, but the divine sage's spiritual self, which is beyond the three gunas. All must be consummated by a divine birth into the higher spiritual nature. But of course, the Gita here is using the language of the Sankhya to show again that tree of the world, with its roots above and its branches below, down at the base are the objects of the senses, and then the senses, and everything builds upon that. And so there is inherent in the cosmic picture a force that carries one up. Progress and liberation are offered to everything that's part of nature. It isn't an eternal sentence to darkness, but rather that we can, using our nature, rise to a higher nature. And we go from the tamasic to the rajasic to the sattvic. And when we reach the sattvic, we have attained the poise of the buddhi, the intelligent will. And we are indeed seated above all the rest of nature. But that itself is not the peak. It's not certainly the spiritual culmination, because in that calm that the buddhi can attain, remember that calm, clear lake that can reflect the nature of the moon in it. Sa, now, buddhi can see the real self, and liberation occurs. One leaves the realm of the intelligent will and enters into the nature of Purusha, the real person, the real soul. So getting to the philosophic equality is a great stride upwards and forwards, and not to be smirked at, but to be attained and kept securely. And Sri Aurobindo continues, all must be consummated by a divine birth into the higher spiritual nature. And the philosopher's equality is like the Stoics, like the world-fleeing ascetics, inwardly a lonely freedom, remote and aloof from men. But the man born to the divine birth has found the divine not only in himself, but in all beings. He has realized his unity with all, and his equality is therefore full of sympathy and oneness. Same self, sama, everything same. So here you see this universal vision almost inbuilt in Sri Aurobindo by his earliest days in yoga. You see it also in Sri Ramana Maharshi. Could see nothing but the same being wherever the glance was cast. The perfect sage. Wait. He sees all as himself and is not intent on his lonely salvation. He even takes upon himself the burden of their happiness and sorrow, by which he is not himself affected or subjected. The perfect sage, the Gita more than once repeats, is ever engaged with a large equality in doing good to all creatures, and makes that his occupation and delight. Sarva bhutahitah rataha. I butchered that. But it's chapter 5, shloka 25. The perfect yogin is no solitary musing on the self in his ivory tower of spiritualization, isolation, but yuktaha kritsna karma krit, a many-sided universal worker for the good of the world, for God in the world. And we just hit 525, 12.4, and 418. Four, he is a bhakta, a lover and devotee of the divine, as well as a sage and a yogin, a lover who loves God wherever he finds him and who finds him everywhere. And what he loves, he does not disdain to serve, nor does action carry him away from the bliss of union. Since all his acts proceed from the one in him and to the one in all they are directed. The equality of the Gita is a large synthetic equality in which all is lifted up into the integrality of the divine being and the divine nature. So that concludes our chapter this evening. And next week we come to chapter 20, Equality and Knowledge. And by the way, if as you read through the material, a question occurs to you and you'd like me to deal with it, why don't you send it to me in advance? And then I can look at it towards the end of the session that we share. And now, I'd like to share with you Reading from Savitri, continuing from where we left off last time, if I can find it. So we'd be in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, and Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release, and we're on page 35. Roughly halfway down. Always the power poured back like sudden rain, or slowly in his breast a presence grew. It clambered back to some remembered height, or soared above the peak from which it fell. Each time he rose, there was a larger poise, a dwelling on a higher spirit plane. The light remained in him a longer space. In this oscillation between earth and heaven, in this ineffable communion's climb, there grew in him, as grows a waxing moon, the glory of the integer of his soul. A union of the real with the unique, a gaze of the alone from every face, the presence of the eternal in the hours, widening the mortal mind's half look on things, bridging the gap between man's force and fate, made whole the fragment being we are here. At last was one a firm spiritual poise, a constant lodging in the eternal's realm, a safety in the silence and the ray, a settlement in the immutable. His heights of being lived in the still self. His mind could rest on a supernal ground and look down on the magic and the play, where the godchild lies on the lap of night and dawn, and the everlasting puts on time's disguise. To the still heights and to the troubled depths, his equal spirit gave its vast assent. A poised serenity of tranquil strength, a wide, unshaken look on time's unrest, faced all experience with unaltered peace. Indifferent to the sorrow and delight, untempted by the marvel and the call, immobile, it beheld the flux of things, calm and apart, supported all that is. His spirit's stillness helped the toiling world. Well, you were kind to join us this evening. You were invited, you were not compelled, so I believe you chose to be here, as indeed your souls chose to be here. So, one never tires of saying it. Listen, you're dear to me. I cherish you. I love you. Stay well. Be well. Do good work, as they say, here and there. And I look forward to seeing you next time. Namaste. Jai Ma.